From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Our economy is in recession, and the civilized world faces unprecedented dangers. Yet the state of our union has never been stronger.
As President Bush declares war on terrorism and the recession in his first State of the Union address, Democracy Now! Convenes our own shadow Congress to respond. We'll speak with Howard Zinn, Ralph Nader, Blanche Wiesen-Cook, Sonali Kolhatkar, and Adolph Reed.
I think the real State of the Union is that as the president last night threatened to extend war all over the globe, at least to stifle dissent from and deflect attention from the real domestic situation, which, as he mentioned, the recession continues. Unemployment's increasing with no end in sight. There's a continuing crisis of affordable housing, access to health care. Increasingly, college education is becoming more expensive and inaccessible. The Social Security system's under attack with constant threat. All public institutions, and we find that we're living increasingly in a one-party state, as the orgy of bipartisanship showed last night.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A senior Red Cross official raised questions last night about a U.S. Special Forces attack on a hospital in the southern Afghan city of Kandahar, in which six al-Qaeda gunmen were killed. The official said U.S. troops had assured him 3 weeks ago there would be no attack on the hospital, which is near a Red Cross center. U.S. and Afghan soldiers stormed a ward of the Mir Weiss Hospital on Monday and gave no warning beforehand. Israel is preparing to fortify its self-proclaimed capital, Jerusalem, amid a show of Arab solidarity with the beleaguered Palestinian administration. Internal Security Minister Uzi Landau, who submitted the proposals to the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, said the plan aims to cut off Palestinians in the West Bank from the city by defensive obstacles, as he put it, but denied earlier reports of a wall being erected to separate Jewish and Arab neighborhoods. Sharon approved the plan, called Enveloping Jerusalem, and said the suburbs of occupied East Jerusalem, quote, should be included in Greater Jerusalem, but only at the security level, thus ruling out an annexation. The Palestinians see Jerusalem as the capital of their future independent state. And this news from Australia. Television footage of an Afghan asylum seeker hurling himself on razor wire at the Woomera Detention Center in South Australia may have succeeded in getting the attention of the Australian government, where domestic and international outrage have failed. 11 Afghan teenagers who made a suicide pact extended their deadline by 24 hours, pledging to kill themselves by this afternoon unless they were released from the desert camp. Lawyers say the teenagers plan to slash their wrists, poison themselves, or jump onto the razor wire. The threat follows desperate measures taken by Afghan and Middle Eastern detainees to draw attention to the conditions in the center. Guards prevented a 16-year-old Iraqi boy from hanging himself overnight. Last week, 9 unaccompanied teenagers, 5 Afghans and 4 Iraqis, said they would commit suicide unless they were freed. They've been removed and placed in the care of South Australian social services. As a hunger strike by more than 200 mainly Afghan asylum seekers entered its 14th day, the Australian government indicated it might back down and close the detention center if the number of people arriving by boat continues to fall. But despite the attention, the Conservative Australian Prime Minister John Howard, who's visiting the United States, continued to defend the government's refugee policies. In the face of fierce international protests, the U.S. may be edging towards acknowledgement that the Geneva Convention applies at least partially to the 158 captives being held at Guantanamo Bay. After President Bush's senior National Security Council advisors failed to resolve the issue, he said he would make the decision after he had, quote, listened to all the legalisms. That is a big shift from the administration's original position that the detainees, said to come from 25 countries, were neither prisoners of war nor entitled to the protections of the conventions. The dispute went public over the weekend with the leak of a White House memo indicating Secretary of State General Colin Powell had asked Bush to reconsider his decision. Powell's concern about the risk of its special forces who may be taken prisoner has resonated at the Pentagon, but even Powell agrees that captured al-Qaeda fighters will not be formally declared prisoners of war. The Pentagon says their fates will be decided on an individual basis. In his State of the Union address last night, Bush appeared to sharply increase both the immediacy and the gravity of the threat posed by Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Bush singled out the countries as an axis of evil whose efforts to acquire and export weapons of mass destruction could no longer be tolerated. Bush's sober rhetoric and the fact that he devoted a major portion of last night's speech to three countries underscored his pledge that the war against terrorism is not limited to rogue groups such as al-Qaeda. The New York Police Department has vowed that protesters at the World Economic Forum, officially beginning tomorrow, can expect a huge police presence with zero tolerance for any violations of the law. The New York Police Department announced it would be unwise to litter or cross against the lights. They also announced they'll enforce an 1845 law that forbids people to wear masks in the street and says that wearing a mask or a hood in a group will be cause for immediate arrest. Much like the days following the so-called terrorist attacks of September 11th, there will be traffic checkpoints, bomb-sniffing dogs, and vehicle searches. The police are also discouraging people from wearing backpacks near the conference in Midtown and plan to use metal detectors for street searches. 4,000 police officers in uniforms and plain clothes will surround the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, where the conference is being held. Post boxes have been removed, manholes welded shut. In case mass arrests happen, a warehouse in the Brooklyn Navy Yards has been prepared to hold up to 1,000 protesters. A former spy master with the Central Intelligence Agency joined the New York Police Department last week to serve as its deputy commissioner for intelligence, a new position that was created to help steer the department through the post-September 11th world. The new deputy commissioner, David Cohen, spent 35 years in the CIA, including 2 years as director of operations, a post in which he oversaw the agency's espionage around the world. Cohen's not the first high-ranking former federal official who's recently joined the police department to help it expand what the department said was fighting crime and cracking down on quality of life violations to gathering intelligence and preparing for terrorism. Frank Labutte, a highly decorated former lieutenant general in the Marines, joined the department earlier this month in another new position, deputy commissioner for counterterrorism.
I'd unravel every riddle for any individual in trouble or in pain. With the thoughts I'd be thinking, I could be another Lincoln if I only had a brain. Oh, I could tell you why the ocean's near the shore. I could think of things I never thunk before. And then I'd sit and think some more. I would not be just a nothing, my head all full of stuffing, my heart all full of pain. And perhaps I deserve you and be even worthier of you if I only had a brain.
Yip Harburg singing "If I Only Had a Brain." You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Resistance Radio. President Bush gave his State of the Union address last night. He spoke for nearly 50 minutes, pausing every few minutes for the boisterous cheers of both Republicans and Democrats. Among the members of the audience, Hamid Karzai, the new Afghan interim ruler, Shannon Spann, the widow of CIA agent Johnny Michael Spann, who died in the Mazar-e Sharif prison, and more military brass than the Capitol building had seen in decades. This is an excerpt of the president's speech.
Our cause is just, and it continues. Our discoveries in Afghanistan confirmed our worst fears and showed us the true scope of the task ahead. We have seen the depth of our enemy's hatred in videos where they laugh about the loss of innocent life. And the depth of their hatred is equaled by the madness of the destruction they design. We have found diagrams of American nuclear power plants and public water facilities, detailed instructions for making chemical weapons, surveillance maps of American cities, and thorough descriptions of landmarks in America and throughout the world. What we have found in Afghanistan confirms that far from ending there, our war against terror is only beginning. Most of the 19 men who hijacked planes on September the 11th were trained in Afghanistan's camps, and so were tens of thousands of others. Thousands of dangerous killers, schooled in the methods of murder, often supported by outlaw regimes, are now spread throughout the world like ticking time bombs set to go off without warning. Thanks to the work of our law enforcement officials and coalition partners, hundreds of terrorists have been arrested. Yet tens of thousands of trained terrorists are still at large. These enemies view the entire world as the battlefield, and we must pursue them wherever they are. So long as training camps operate, so long as nations harbor terrorists, freedom is at risk, and America and our allies must not and will not allow it. Our nation. Our nation will continue to be steadfast and patient and persistent in the pursuit of two great objectives. First, we will shut down terrorist camps, disrupt terrorist plans, and bring terrorists to justice. And second, we must prevent the terrorists and regimes who seek chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons from threatening the United States and the world. Our military has put the terror training camps of Afghanistan out of business. Yet camps still exist in at least a dozen countries. A terrorist underworld, including groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, Yash-e-Mohammed, operates in remote jungles and deserts and hides in the centers of large cities. While the most visible military action is in Afghanistan, America is acting elsewhere. We now have troops in the Philippines helping to train that country's armed forces to go after terrorist cells that have executed an American and still hold hostages. Our soldiers, working with the Bosnian government, seized terrorists who were plotting to bomb our embassy. Our Navy is patrolling the coast of Africa to block the shipment of weapons and the establishment of terrorist camps in Somalia. My hope is that all nations will heed our call and eliminate the terrorist parasites who threaten their countries and our own. Many nations are acting forcefully. Pakistan is now cracking down on terror, and I admire the strong leadership of President Musharraf. But some governments will be timid in the face of terror. And make no mistake about it, if they do not act, America will. Our second goal is to prevent regimes that sponsor terror from threatening America or our friends and allies with weapons of mass destruction. Some of these regimes have been pretty quiet since September the 11th, but we know their true nature. North Korea is a regime arming with missiles and weapons of mass destruction while starving its citizens. Iran aggressively pursues these weapons and exports terror, while an unelected few repress the Iranian people's hope for freedom. Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax and nerve gas and nuclear weapons for over a decade. This is a regime that has already used poison gas to murder thousands of its own citizens, leaving the bodies of mothers huddled over their dead children. This is a regime that agreed to international inspections, then kicked out the inspectors. This is a regime that has something to hide from the civilized world. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world by seeking weapons of mass destruction. These regimes pose a grave and growing danger. They could provide these arms to terrorists, giving them the means to match their hatred. They could attack our allies or attempt to blackmail the United States. In any of these cases, the price of indifference would be catastrophic. We will work closely with our coalition to deny terrorists and their state sponsors the materials, technology, and expertise to make and deliver weapons of mass destruction. We will develop and deploy effective missile defenses to protect America and our allies from sudden attack. And all nations should know America will do what is necessary to ensure our nation's security. We'll be deliberate. Yet time is not on our side. I will not wait on events while dangers gather. I will not stand by as peril draws closer and closer. The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons. Our war on terror has well begun, but it has only begun. This campaign may not be finished on our watch, yet it must be, and it will be, waged on our watch. We can't stop.
You're listening to President Bush's State of the Union.
Leaving terror camps intact and terror states unchecked, our sense of security would be false and temporary. History has called America and our allies to action, and it is both our responsibility and our privilege to fight freedom's fight.
President George Bush, the State of the Union address last night, his first. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. When we come back from our break, Howard Zinn and Blanche Wiesen-Cook, Adolf Reed and Ralph Nader, Sonali Kolhatkar, respond. We'll be back in a minute.
Gun your machines and run them wild. Fly your flag, it's the latest style. Fill your gas tank to the brim, then turn the volume up to 10. Dull your senses, clench your fist. You won't notice driving over that cliff. Who's stepping? Life is different now, except Promises will not be kept. Experts will keep you all informed. So go shopping and keep that TV warm. All for one, one for all. United we stand, united we fall. Goose-stepping.
Goose-stepping by Suzanne McDermott, another listener who has sent in her music, and you can send yours to us as well by sending it to Post Office Box 693, New York, New York, 1013. That's Post Office Box 693, New York, New York, 1013. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. As we convene our own shadow Congress to respond to President Bush's State of the Union address, we'll begin with radical historian Howard Zinn. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, the last words brought us right to you. History has called America and our allies to action, and it's both our responsibility and our privilege to fight freedom's fight. Your response?
Yeah. Well, what Bush promises us is an endless war, a war that will go on and on and on. He promises not only for his administration, but for future administrations. And what he does is create an atmosphere, really, of a kind of hysteria about enemies everywhere that will keep the country in a state of fear for a very long time, and that will enable the administration to use the resources of this country instead of to take care of people's needs, to build up an even greater military machine, to send our troops and our ships to all over the world to wage war on other countries. In other words, he promises that war on Afghanistan will then become a war on Iran, a war on Iraq. And he says at one point that the terrorists have camps in at least a dozen countries. We're going to wage war on a dozen countries. He has created, and to this enormous applause of, you know, Democrats and Republicans, really a very sorry spectacle for somebody who thinks he or she lives in a democracy, this unanimity. He's created a situation in which we are going to have a militarized state in which our civil liberties will be permanently impaired, in which the citizens will be in constant danger of being arrested. I mean, we have 20 million non-citizens in this country also, and these non-citizens will be subject to the provisions of the Patriot Act, which means they can be held and detained. In other words, he's creating a wartime situation which is going to go on, and inevitably, when all of this concentration on war and building up the military goes on, the real needs of people will be unmet. I mean, people are already dying on the streets of Boston who are homeless and cold. This is happening in other cities in the country. And the Bush administration, I listened to his speech last night, uncomfortably, of course, forcing myself to do it. But there he was making grand statements about health and education when actually even in the first year of his administration, he's already cut federal spending for, you know, pediatric training for doctors, for, you know, research into more efficient energy sources, and, you know, reduced program for public hospitals and for public housing. All of the grand things that he threw out about helping the environment and helping health and education, total fabrications, empty promises, considering what he has already done in the first year and what undoubtedly will become even worse as this permanent war goes on.
Historian Blanche Wiesen Cook, as you listened to Zinn and listened to George Bush last night, and with your background of research into various presidencies, you wrote the biography of Eisenhower, the declassified Eisenhower, and Eleanor Roosevelt, a biography, and working on her third volume of that book. What was your response?
Oh, Amy, I just want to say it was wonderful to hear Howard Zinn, who I use his book in all of my courses, just to hear you and Howard in a moment of sanity, and I love Howard's expression, a sorry spectacle. It was really a tragic thing to watch, this bipartisan, just astonishing, really, to see this bipartisan exuberance for words that were horribly chilling. And I think there are two issues here. You know, today is FDR's 120th birthday, and when you think about a time when there was poverty and homelessness, which there is now, there are 7 to 10 million homeless Americans, and bipartisan silence about the suffering of people. And you think about the 30s when folks were faced with rising fascism, and there was this effort to make things, really to make things better, not to cut budgets for public education, not to cut budgets for public housing. We haven't had one single federal dollar invested in new housing starts since Ronald Reagan. This incredible situation. And then the war front. I think all of us agree that a group of terrorists have declared war on the United States. We've seen it. We know it. You are broadcasting from Ground Zero. And that's real. But what is not real is how we are going to deal with it. We are not, you know, no war has ever achieved victory. And Eisenhower once said, there are no final victories. The idea that we can deal with terrorism or with terrorists like the folks who became Taliban, Al-Qaeda, by just bombing what? North Korea, Iraq, Iran? I mean, this speech was so incredible when you think, if you just pause at any one of these places, like Iraq, where over 1 million children have died because of our embargo, where there's a health embargo, where there's a food embargo, where there's incredible, unbearable suffering, and that's off the screen. And then you just, anywhere you look, there's an article in the New Yorker, I believe, about how a Red Cross worker was tortured because the Taliban was illiterate and they saw in his pocket a cross, and they thought he'd become a convert to Christianity. And you're looking at illiteracy. And from our point of view, if you look at causes, if you look at issues, the fact that the Middle East, for example, the Israel-Palestine issue, which is the most emotional issue on the table, was not even mentioned. And then you look at the New York Times as an interview with the Prince of Saudi Arabia, who says, when you uproot trees, when you blast houses, when you kill children by shooting them in the face, you encourage people to become suicide bombers. And it's so obvious that the way to deal with this situation is to begin to consider several things, several major things. We had a Manhattan Project to get a nuclear bomb. We need now a Manhattan Project for alternative energy sources, wind power, solar power. We need a Manhattan Project for literacy and security, so that poverty will end, so that folks will live full and decent lives, so there will ultimately be more to live for than to die for. And instead of thinking about ways in which we can create a society in which there are more to live for than to die for, we are thinking only of bombing and an escalation of this worldwide madness. I was really particularly revolted to hear this notion that weapons of mass destruction are around in dozens of countries, when for years many of us in the peace movement were saying, why don't we stop supplying? The U.S. is the single largest supplier. That's what the military-industrial complex is all about. We are the single largest supplier of military weapons around the world. What a crazy thing to do. And, you know, so you just look at these situations. We could end them, but instead of ending them, we are building them. Right. I'm not saying we shouldn't have intelligence operations. Of course we should. I'm not saying we shouldn't protect ourselves. Of course we must. But this is not the way to do it. This is insanity. And I think, you know, what Howard said about creating an atmosphere of hysteria, creating an atmosphere of fear is truly, truly amazing. And then you factor in what the other piece of this domestic situation, which is our right to know. There was an executive order to end the Presidential Papers Act that President Bush announced in November, EO-13223, which says, you know, we're just not going to release papers. And then Attorney General Ashcroft said he gave a message to all government agencies to end the Freedom of Information Act. And so the whole question of our right to know is being attacked and eroded. And I just would like to point out, everybody who listens to your program, of course, knows this, but it's kind of an astonishing fact. Afghanistan was the first major war without any witnesses. You know, the U.S. bought up all of the satellite photos so that the press just couldn't see what was going on.
Blanche Wiesenthal-Cook, I wanted to bring Adolf Reed into the discussion, a professor of political science at New School University here in New York. His books include W.E.B. Du Bois and American Political Thought and Class Notes, Posing as Politics and Other Thoughts on the American Political Scene. As we talk about the costs of war abroad and look at the costs of war here at home, I was looking at the photograph and last night, the picture of those that surrounded Laura Bush. This is the prime seats in the House because this is where the camera will go most often. Yes, it was Hamid Karzai, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and the head of the Women's Political Affairs Department of Afghanistan behind her. But right there, just a few seats away, was James Hoffa, the head of the Teamsters. You're in the Labor Party. Labor and class are among your major issues. What is your response to that?
Well, I mean, it's not surprising given what the administration's been trying to do with the labor movement since Bush came in. I mean, one of their objectives, and they were kind of clever about it, was to use energy deregulation and especially Alaska oil drilling to sort of break off unions that had been, especially unions from the industrial sector that had been most prominent in the anti-WTO alliance, the Teamsters. They tried to get the steel workers and mine workers and others. And they've had more success with some unions than with others. I think they've been maybe less successful with the steel workers. And it's a clever move on the administration's part. It's what you would expect. It's sort of playing to, you know, the constant trade-off that any unionist has between following the sort of Sam Gompers-like imperative to do the best for your members that you can under the not necessarily desirable options that confront you at any moment versus thinking for some, you know, down the road for some larger goal and some larger vision. I think another expression of this that we've seen with some other unions has been some of these guys have been talking more openly about a strategy of actively improving relationships with Republican officeholders generally, both at the state level, local level, And that's maybe coming a little more from public sector unions. I understand that one prominent head of a national union said that this is their version of a Labor Party to sort of play the Republicans against the Democrats. It's, as I say, it's not surprising. I mean, I think generally Bush has done sort of what we expect him to do. And to be really honest about it, I mean, I think that after, I mean, admittedly, my expectations were very, very low. But when I woke up on the morning of September 11th and found out what happened, and then when the second plane hit and I realized it wasn't just a drunken pilot or something, my first thought was, oh God, I hope they don't nuke somebody, right? So, from that low threshold of expectation, I haven't been quite as shocked or appalled by the way they've operated as I guess maybe I could have been. And also in the early stages of this, the tensions within the administration seemed in a way to be slowing things down a little bit and working to our advantage, temporary advantage, at least to moderate the horror. But I mean, I just want to pick up on something that both Blanche Wiesenkook and Howard Zinn commented on, which is this, I think it's significant that the thrust, or at least the early thrust of the speech, was around the foreign policy stuff, because that's been, the sort of bread and circuses for us, or that they offer us. It's a way of stifling dissent. It's a way of building a false unity. But it also kind of connects with what I think is a sort of, is a role that Bush's father carved out for the U.S. internationally, which is, I've been calling it the Pinkertons of world capitalism, basically, or of the neoliberal system. And in that sense, the human rights thing didn't quite work for them as a vehicle to use to give a moral patina to playing this role all over the world, because it's too complicated. The anti-terrorism thing is perfect. It's perfect, and it looks a little bit like, it makes me feel a little bit like the way the British used the slave trade in the late 19th century as an excuse to spread colonialism, through the African continent, right? When you were going to stamp out the slave trade. But it also, and I think, this is why it's a little more open-ended on the domestic front. I think it's also a convenient image to have hovering there, right? This could be a completely wrong reading, but I was almost a little reassured that he included North Korea and Iran along with Iraq as the states that he singled out last night, because that seemed to me to make it somewhat less likely that he was planning to attack anybody in the immediate future. I find it hard to believe they're going to bomb Iran soon. I find it even harder to believe that they're going to bomb, North Korea soon.
One friend suggested bringing North Korea into the picture now as a way to assure the Muslim world, just as Colombia has been brought up, that it's not only about Muslims.
Could be.
That this man who is not popularly elected president, who's declared war on the world, means it. It's everyone who's a target. But we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to hear a little more of the speech, get a response from a woman who we've talked to often about the women of Afghanistan, as one of the leading women of Afghanistan was sitting in the balcony with Laura Bush. And we are going to hear from Ralph Nader as well. Adolf Reed is our guest in our Firehouse studio. He is professor of political science at New School University, what was New School for Social Research. On the line with us, Blanche Wiesenkook, historian. We'll be speaking with Sonali Kohathar of Afghan Women's Mission, again, and Ralph Nader, consumer activist and former presidential candidate. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and you can get a copy of today's program by calling the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can go to our website at democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
We're just like a tree.
We Shall Not Be Moved. Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we convene our own shadow Congress to respond to President-elect Bush's State of the Union address, his first, it was 50 minutes last night, joint session of Congress, a speech that can be hand-delivered, but the approach now has been to actually deliver that speech. The last time that President Bush stood before Congress, it was just days after the September 11th terror attacks. On that evening, he declared in no uncertain terms his so-called war on terror. Now, nearly 5 months later, he's pledged to push that war still farther to a dozen countries beyond Afghanistan that he said harbor so-called terrorist camps. He also warned of an axis of evil nations like North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, and said the United States would not allow them to threaten the world with weapons of mass destruction. To these ends, he asked Congress to increase Pentagon spending by nearly $50 billion. It would be, Bush boasted, the largest increase in military spending in two decades. This is how he began last night's address.
We last met in an hour of shock and suffering. In four short months, our nation has comforted the victims, begun to rebuild New York and the Pentagon, rallied a great coalition, captured, arrested, and rid the world of thousands of terrorists, destroyed Afghanistan's terrorist training camps, saved a people from starvation, and freed a country from brutal oppression. The American flag flies again over our embassy in Kabul. Terrorists who once occupied Afghanistan now occupy cells at Guantanamo Bay. And terrorist leaders who urged followers to sacrifice their lives are running for their own. America and Afghanistan are now allies against terror. We'll be partners in rebuilding that country. And this evening, we welcomed the distinguished interim leader of a liberated Afghanistan, Chairman Hamid Karzai. Last time we met in this chamber, the mothers and daughters of Afghanistan were captives in their own homes, forbidden from working or going to school. Today, women are free and are part of Afghanistan's new government, and we welcome the new Minister of Women's Affairs, Dr. Seema Sumar.
That was President Bush, opening address of the State of the Union last night, joint session of Congress. On the line with us, Sonali Kohatkar, spokesperson for Afghan Women's Mission, which works closely with RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. So there you had last night Hamid Karzai, the new head of Afghanistan. Interesting that he should be in the balcony next to Laura Bush, is just before he was announced as the new leader of Afghanistan at the Bonn Conference. The U.S. military bombed his headquarters, injured him, and then at his inauguration, leading up to it, a caravan of tribal leaders that were going to celebrate his inauguration were also bombed by the U.S. forces and killed. Sonali Kohatkar, what did you make of the fact that sitting with Laura Bush was the new head of the Afghan Women's Affairs Department?
Well, it's interesting that they're, you know, it's very obvious that Bush is doing what everybody has done with respect to Afghanistan in the past, which is use the issue of Afghan women's rights to further, you know, policies that are hard to swallow, because everybody wanted to see Afghan women be the real winners in this situation, since the oppression of Afghan women has been given such international attention, and feminists all over the world have been absolutely horrified by what had happened in Afghanistan. By pointing to Seema Samar, however, he's pointing to one of a handful of women who have been put into the new interim government, who were essentially handpicked by the U.S. government. Hamid Karzai himself was picked by the U.S. government when the delegates in Bonn actually picked somebody else. He didn't even receive one vote. And reports have come out that from people such as Medea Benjamin, who visited with Global Exchange last year, that the women who were put into power in the interim government were mostly handpicked due to family connections, and those women who are fighting on the forefront of Afghan women's rights were totally left out. And it's very interesting that Bush, you know, uses this as a means to talk about how free women are in Afghanistan now, because if you look at what's really happening in Afghanistan, more refugees are streaming out than going back in. The country is starving. I mean, it's a situation that has gotten worse and not better. And you now hear the residents of Kabul say things like, we wish the Taliban were back because the insecurity is so great. Afghanistan is being ruled by warlords who were fighting so hard in the mid-1990s that when the Taliban came into power, Afghans initially welcomed them with open arms. These are the same men that the country has essentially been handed back to. And if we think that Afghan women are now free, we're seriously mistaken. Justice Karimi, who is the person who's going to be essentially making, you know, creating a set of laws for Afghan cities in Afghanistan, declared openly that, yes, they will still be practicing Sharia law, the Islamic law, except it'll be less harsh. For example, you know, people can still be, men and women can still be stoned to death for committing adultery. They'll just use smaller stones than the Taliban used. I mean, this is no improvement on the issue of women's rights. And Afghan women are not only struggling as much as they were before, it's almost worse now than it was before the United States bombed the Taliban out of existence and put into power another group of terrorists.
Sonali Kothar is with the Afghan Women's Mission, on the line with us from California, on the line with us from Washington, D.C., Ralph Nader, who ran for president on the Green Party ticket. His book that's just out is Crashing the Party, Taking on the Corporate Government in an Age of Surrender. Now not competing with Al Gore, but with Noam Chomsky on the bestseller list of the New York Times. Congratulations, Ralph Nader.
Thank you.
Your response to President Bush's address last night, particularly focusing on issues of, I was going to say Enron, but he didn't. He talked about corporate responsibility.
Well, he, of course, had to distance himself from the Enron scandal. His ties and his administration officials' ties are so close and have been for so many years. But the sentence was very perfunctory relating to corporate accountability, and he contradicts himself repeatedly. For example, he talks about protecting 401ks and then urges personal accounts for young people on Social Security. He did not mention at all campaign finance reform, which certainly is at the core of preventing any future Enrons, unlike Dick Gephardt, who did mention campaign finance reform, which is now coming up in the House of Representatives. And in many ways, he didn't answer the obvious questions of $48 billion more in military spending on top of $320 billion Pentagon budget, which Donald Rumsfeld himself said is not being spent wisely. What is going to be lost as a result of that in terms of domestic programs, health and safety, and rebuilding our public works? There's a free lunch here as long as it's in the military budget. He made no mention of the corporate crime wave in the country. It isn't just Enron. It was a speech that omitted a lot of things that should not have been omitted. And his contradiction started right in his first sentence when he said the the nation is at war, our economy is in recession, the civilized world faces unprecedented dangers, yet the state of our union has never been stronger. That has to be a logical leap.
What about what we're seeing with the police in this country, sort of the corollary of the military abroad? Starting tomorrow, the World Economic Forum is going to be meeting in New York. 3,000 corporate leaders, politicians will be at the Waldorf Astoria. They're already sealing off the whole area, said people who wear masks can be arrested. What about this issue of the militarization of civil society?
Well, that's the long-range damage from 9/11 and the Bush administration and the Democrats' reaction to it. You know, there is no permissible discussion in this country on the question, is there such a thing as an overreaction to 9/11, vastly exaggerating the terrorist network all over the world? I mean, there's supposed to be tens of thousands of them, specially trained, according to Bush. There hasn't been a single strike by them anywhere in the world since September 11th. Maybe they're a lot weaker. But, of course, it's necessary to exaggerate foreign perils, as General Douglas MacArthur pointed out in 1957, in order to justify gigantic budgets, in order to be able to fill the coffers of the commercial militarists like Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Raytheon, in order to meet the demands of the autocratic ideologues restricting our civil liberties and constitutional freedoms like John Ashcroft, and in order to meet the avaricious and unpatriotic demands of corporations here in Congress demanding subsidies, bailouts, giveaways, limited liability, tax loopholes, allegedly blaming their problems on 9/11. So the enormous and consequential and building damage to our political economy and our constitutional freedoms that come from 9/11 has not been sufficiently or even partially discussed in this country. And, of course, that is not what the terrorists did to us. That is what our government and the corporate power brokers are doing to America. And he never, of course, went into that at all. There is no limit to the amount of time and amount of priority and amount of money that's addressed to what he calls the international terrorist threat. But he didn't spend a word saying what he's going to do about 5,000 preventable American deaths every week from medical malpractice, auto crashes, air pollution, and occupational toxic and trauma hazards. 5,000 every week, didn't get a single note, didn't get a single sentence. And that's why we're dealing with a one-track government, with a one-track president who knows, like other rulers in other lands throughout history, if you exaggerate a foreign threat wildly, you maintain your power in your own country and widespread poll support. And it's time to open up a broad public debate here in terms of proportionality and to ask why certain tens of thousands of American lives can be lost every few weeks in this country from preventable conditions are completely ignored, while the focus is on the international guerrilla terrorists, by the way, which have not exactly been deterred by what Bush has been doing. He's burned down a haystack in Afghanistan, further devastating hundreds of thousands of innocent people in that country in order to find a few needles, and he hasn't found the needles yet. So even military strategists are capable of saying, did you take the right military option in the way you pursued the backers, the attackers, or was there a better way? And that's the Center for Defense Information and a lot of retired admirals and generals who were never heard from, who fought in real wars, who were never heard from in the post-September 11th debate on what essentially was state-controlled television. So conforming were the opinions.
Finally, on the issue of Enron, do you think it could bring this administration down when you look at how close Ken Lay was allied with President Bush, campaign advisor, financier, yet they have managed to distance themselves very well from this?
But the media is doing a very good job here, and they're all competing with one another with page one stories on the Enron tentacles, and if there are closer connections, if there are favors, and certainly there was 10 years of favors under both Democrats and Republicans for Enron in terms of regulatory abdication and legislation on their energy futures trading. If there are contacts, they're going to be documented. It's not up to Bush to control this. It's really out of his control. I noticed that Bush talked about 4,000 hours of civic service, and then he offered government options. You know, the government Freedom Corps and AmeriCorps and the Peace Corps, which is fine. But he could have also said that the private civil society has a great deal to offer too, like our new group CitizenWorks.org, which would be very happy to hear and receive the time of citizens all over the country who want to engage in fundamental reform for a stronger democracy.
Adolph Reed is with us in the studio. These protests that are planned for this weekend, how would you tie them into the State of the Union address as we wrap up today?
Well, I mean, I think they obviously connect with the State of the Union. They're an expression of a lot of the problems, or they bubble up from a lot of the problems that Bush skirted talking about in the State of the Union. I mean, the key thing I want to point out about this, though, is, I mean, I guess they connect principally as a reminder that we've got to do stuff. I mean, I think Democracy Now!'s audience, it's safe to assume, wasn't mousetrapped by Bush's speech last night. We pretty much got what we expected. And I think one of the things that progressives in this country have fallen into is sort of fighting back on our heels. So every 4 years we look for an answer. When we find that we're confronted with unacceptable options, and all the time in between we sort of do the same stuff, make important acts of bearing witness, whatever. But I think by and large our movement has gotten away from trying to connect with people who don't already agree with us, and from trying to build broad bases, right? Frankly, I mean, this may be a kind of unpopular thing to say, but while it's obviously important to have demonstrations of a protest to express moral outrage, I think the demonstrations are not terribly useful anymore as an organizing tactic because they don't really connect us, because of the corporate dominance of the media, they don't really connect us with that big public that we need to win.
We have 10 seconds. Ralph Nader, would you agree?
I wasn't able to hear that.
His comment was simply that the protest may not be the most effective way to build a movement right now.
Well, peaceful protest at the point of concentration where these people are meeting is the most effective media way, because there's no other way. Press conferences, reports don't get media, but the message is conveyed by these peaceful demonstrations. I just want to add one quick thing, Amy. The one thing Bush ignored stood out very prominently is domestic terrorism, that is the anthrax situation. And that, of course, has generated huge fear and anxiety, and it's overwhelmingly believed in intelligence circles that is domestic.
Well,
why he didn't focus on that at all is an interesting question.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you for being with us, Adolph Reed and Ralph Nader. Democracy Now!, produced by Miranda Kennedy and Lizzie Ratner, Anthony Siliner, music maestro and engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! Tomorrow, we will be talking about the World Economic Forum.
Before them turn us into monkey, we tell you, make we hear some important things we do. We are big government, they hide from us, you. We go expose them. Yeah.